Welcome to Intel on AI, a podcast series that brings you the latest on cutting-edge tech driving artificial intelligence in the enterprise today. And now your hosts, Derek Osborne and Emily Hudson.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Intel on AI podcast. I'm Emily Hudson, and we are recording live at the Intel AI Summit in sunny San Francisco, one of those 70 degrees November days that we get sometimes here. And with me today is Ben Taylor, the Chief Data Officer of Zeph. Welcome, Ben.
Thanks for having me.
So tell me a little bit about what you are doing here today at the AI Summit.
So we're showing off some of the work we've been doing with deepfakes. So for people that aren't familiar with deepfakes, they're a concerning new part of technology that's been ramping up where I can imitate a face and make a lay audience believe that someone is saying or doing things they never did. And that is especially concerning for the 2020 elections coming up. But it's even more concerning for true crimes like wire transfer, where now, before I could maybe call and impersonate a CEO, but now I can do a live video conference and ask for a wire transfer from a CFO. And so you'll see these types of crimes, and we need ways to get some hooks in there and do detection. So that's what I'm doing today, is I'm showing off some of the work we've been doing with blood flow analysis in regards to deep fake detection.
So blood flow analysis, meaning you are analyzing the blood flow of the person's face as they're talking and seeing if it's accurate?
Yeah. And one of the things they've noticed about deep fakes is there are some signs that they're not living. And so the early one was blinking. So the deep fakes aren't blinking correctly. And this is a moving goalpost problem. So whatever good idea we come up with, that's a good idea we can use to improve them. So now they blink better. But one of the things that people haven't been talking about as much in the industry is a deep fake won't have a believable heart rate. In the future, they will. And so we're showing today that we can do some pretty surprising things with the blood flow analysis by locking down the face and looking in time when someone's talking.
So where do you generate the historical data that you're comparing this to?
So lucky for us, other companies are doing it. So this is a big enough priority that Facebook, Microsoft, the FBI, and Google have all made announcements in the last couple months. And Google has offered up a data set that we've been using. And then Facebook and Microsoft will offer one up in December.
Well, I'm kind of terrified here at the other end of the table looking at Ben, but curious, you today are showing off a demonstration of how this works, and you are running this on Intel hardware?
Yes, and so one of the major issues with AI problems is they're big. They're really big, and even with big enterprise hardware, we run into issues with not having enough threads, running out of memory. And I've been using GPUs for a long time, and this has been a constant issue we've run into, having to fight our batch sizes and knock down the unit of work because of memory issues. And so the machine that we've been working on has blown open those constraints where we have 12 terabytes of active memory. And so memory is not an issue currently, where it always has been.
And this is on Xeon Scalable?
Yes.
And is that why you're wearing your Intel Blue toenail polish today?
I think that's by chance. But the funny thing is I've been wearing toenail polish for years to professional conferences, and I've made some surprisingly good networking connections because I ruffle feathers that way. So I go to conferences where everyone's a PhD and they're wearing blue suits, and there I am with my flip-flops and my toenail polish.
It's a nice way to set yourself apart, but also find perhaps some like-minded folks.
Yeah, and I try to fight some of the social norms that you see for these more academic conferences.
Excellent. Besides your deepfake project, I'm sure that you have some other things you're tinkering with. What else is happening at Zeph?
Yeah, so with the stuff that makes us money, we focus on solving enterprise problems. And I think AI is really interesting because the vast majority of AI projects fail, but we see projects that are transformational. And by transformational, I truly mean they transform a company all the way up to the board level where they're spilling over into a new market. And so when AI is applied correctly, it's not a cool thing to have, a nice thing to have. It can be game-changing for a company, whether you're in advertising, manufacturing, insurance. It really gives you the ability to finally get a return on the data that you've been investing with people over time. And in the case of my old employer, HireVue, they were able to spill into a bigger market because of AI and automation.
So how are these companies, are they coming to you saying, you know, I have a bunch of data, transform my business, I have a problem, help me solve it? Are people just stumbling on these sort of business transformation, or do they have a clue?
Most people don't have a clue. AI is a tricky thing to sell. In a perfect world, everyone would have a case study. That's what they want. But if you are trying to predict loss in insurance, my case study with cancer prediction doesn't really work. For some examples, we can offer up case studies for these bigger verticals. But the fun thing I've noticed in the industry is, even though a lot of AI projects fail, AI is much more advanced than people realize. And so we've had a lot of traction just showing people some of these more advanced examples where they can't believe what they're seeing. They are shocked that AI is capable of detecting blood flow for deepfakes, or some of the other things we've done, playing the Xbox and stuff like that. Where, a real quick aside, we taught AI to predict ABC's The Bachelor, Bachelorette. Really silly.
That's hilarious.
Not useful.
It might be. I think that people actually bet on that show. So,
well, we did it just kind of as a fun marketing piece, but we've had executives call us, and their business has nothing to do with an online dating show, but we've kind of pulled the rug out from under them. And now they want to understand how AI could be used for their business.
Now, did you correctly predict the outcome of The Bachelor or Bachelorette?
For some seasons, we did. So for season 22, we did. And that one is a fun one because the human, the bachelor, he picked our AI's number third pick. Mm-hmm. And then 2 weeks later, he changed his mind and picked our AI's number one pick. And we did The Bachelorette too. And so we can say that we can quantify that men are more shallow than women. We have a coefficient.
Excellent. Shallowness coefficient. I love it. On a perhaps more serious note, I mean, we all know and I think believe that AI is transformative. You know, what other benefits are you really excited about for the future besides predicting the outcome of a reality TV dating show?
Yeah, so AI is an amplifier, and it will amplify human behavior. We have seen examples where it can amplify bad behavior, so we want to be very aware of that. But for some of the good behavior, I could not be more excited about the future. You're going to see big advances in the smart home. For my personal home, I have 7 security cameras. But as you add more security cameras, you need AI to route all that information because you don't want your phone to constantly go off. You want everything to be actionable. And so having a smarter home means a safer home. And anyone listening who has young children can get into trouble just as a statistic. And having a smart home is a wonderful way to protect the family, but also from a health perspective. You'll walk into your bathroom in the morning, you'll look in the mirror, and the mirror will know more about you than your doctor today. And that is not science fiction. These are all technologies that are coming together at the right time, and that's stuff that we'll be able to look forward to in the next 5 to 10 years.
So with your smart home example, you need AI to interpret all this data that you're getting from your 7 cameras, because yeah. Like you said, you don't want a phone notification every time like the cat walks by a window. You want to know what you need to do and flag that. So that's really interesting.
Yeah. And we have been using that kind of as an R&D playground to play with some of these events that are worth escalating. And some of them are not just around security. They're around raising a family. So I have a 5-year-old boy who's very active. And if he gets into the fridge, that's fine. But if he's getting milk and eggs out of the fridge and he's doing a project on the floor, that's a problem. But there's enough information in the video feed that should be something that I don't need to find. The system should be able to figure out from the video data that this is an unusual event, and I have flagged this type of event before.
Now, do you have your system programmed to then say in a stern voice, put away the milk and the eggs right now?
I haven't done that, but we have joked about it disabling the Xbox if it hears fighting, which would be very doable. And then it's not my fault. If the kids are upset because the Xbox isn't working, you can sympathize with them and say, I'm so sorry. Were you guys fighting again? And so there's a big assist that could come. Some people might complain and say that sounds like we're turning over too much responsibility to a system, but there is a lot of good that will come from this.
Now, from a personal privacy perspective, do your kids know that they are being watched when they take things from the refrigerator they shouldn't?
Yes. And this is just becoming, we're just building on it. And the one I am the most excited about is the fight detector or the cry detector. Because it's actionable. Something is happening and either someone will have a consequence or an adult needs to intervene.
You know, as a mother, you know, I can certainly tell when my baby's crying and it's I'm hungry, I'm bored, or I need help cry. So yeah. Interesting to see how AI can learn that as well.
And that's a great example you bring up. That's usually the litmus test that we use. If a human can tell, then AI definitely can. And we can find examples where AI still can, even if a human can't. But if a human can, then today, as we enter 2020, there really aren't a lot of concerns on whether or not AI can do that too, if the data quality is there. Back in 2012, 2013, this was black magic. It was all new. Deep learning was the hottest thing out there. You could not hire talent. And a lot of people that are in the space have been really surprised how quickly this has moved. Yeah. So for people that do this every day, the amount of progress we've made in 4 years is surprising.
That was kind of my next thought in terms of resources and, you know, my hypothetical baby cry detector. Do I have to train that model or how does that happen?
So there are AutoML software layers that are improving over time. And a lot of the stuff we've seen in the open source community have made those types of models very easy. And one of the things I like to say is the principal consultant today is the free intern tomorrow. And I've seen that in my career. So stuff that I would be paid to work on for a week as a consultant, 5 years later, we would expect a free intern to demonstrate the same thing in a few lines of code. But 5 years ago, it didn't take a few lines of code. So this cry detector, that's transitioning over to the hobbyist level where you don't need to be an expert. You can download a few blogs and a few lines of code. You can get something very competitive that 3 years ago would have been a PhD project.
So, you know, we're talking, I think, in this case about the democratization of AI and technology. And I'm assuming you're firmly on this, you know, the open source accessibility spectrum, but I'd like to hear your take on that.
It's funny because I am a data scientist, an AI researcher. I've employed data scientists before, so you think I would advocate for them. But when it comes to the business, we find communication bottlenecks, poor business acumen. These people are incredibly smart, but sometimes they can be a bottleneck. And so there is a big push in the industry right now to enable the engineer. So for AI projects that are successful, we typically see them as a team effort. There's not a unicorn hire. There's not some magical person you can go grab. We see it as a team effort. And that team usually involves an engineer who can get the data, an AI expert or an AI expert system, because software, I think, will eventually kind of move in there, and then the subject matter expert. And unfortunately, a lot of times people forget the subject matter expert because they may not be a very senior person in your company. They could be an underwriter. They could be a technician manager. They could be someone who's not actually at the table, but their opinion matters most.
They're closest to the data, right, in a way.
They're closest to the data, and we have grown a lot of respect for this individual because coming from the AI or the data science perspective, we might try to throw a statistic at you that, hey, the AUC score is this or the accuracy is this, but it doesn't matter what that number is. I have had plenty of experiences where that number is garbage or a low number is fantastic, and it's not really for the AI expert to determine that, but for the domain expert, they know value. And so if you're trying to get a project that's transformational, you need to work really closely with a domain expert. And that has not been easy. But in the spirit of progress, we see tools coming online. Storytelling with AI is becoming much better. 4 years ago, forget it. How are you going to convince a domain expert who's not technical that the neural net is doing what it's supposed to? But a lot of progress has been made. And so everyone benefits in the open source community. There's lots of great tools out there today.
Ben, interesting that we're talking about AI and teams and work teams. I think one of the concerns that people have in our AI future is, you know, am I going to be out of a job? Are robots going to do my work for me? What is your take on that? How do we bridge that gap and make people understand that AI is an asset to their lives and being used for good? Are there ethical guidelines you're following? Are there things that you're flagging?
So we've seen this out there in the industry firsthand. When we're talking to a leadership team, we will ask where they're bottlenecked by human capital. So we are hunting for human capital bottlenecks, but what we've seen is when AI comes in and in some cases beats the human equivalent, it doesn't mean the humans were laid off immediately. What it means is their role, which was very transactional, now transitions into something that's more creative. So they're literally partnering with the AI system on what are the features that were used, what is all the data that matters, do we have other data out there that we could go after? And so it's kind of the opposite, because you would think doom and gloom, AI is going to come in, it's going to predict advertising better than you, so you're out of a job. And we kind of see the opposite for now. There will be jobs out there that are replaced. Maybe we won't have as many truck drivers on the road, or we won't have as many radiologists reviewing scans.
Although from what I hear, the radiologist workload is ever increasing, and so the radiologist, to your point, may be doing things other than sifting through tens of thousands of scans a day and applying their education and their knowledge in other ways.
And they might be discovering new diseases because they're focusing more work on the creative side where they don't have to deal with this high volume load. One of the things we've seen, so you have the job argument out there, and I would always recommend to embrace it because it can allow your employer to be more competitive. It can help you be more competitive. It is an amplifier, and that can be good when you have a domain expert that's amplified. But kind of pulling on that thread a little bit, it can also be a bad amplifier. And we've seen this in the news. You can look at companies that have been called out for building a resume model or building a gender classifier where they haven't been as thoughtful. And in those examples where there's been bad press, it gets back to the domain expert. So in all those examples where there was bad press, there wasn't an IO psychologist or there wasn't the responsible party that would typically be there. And so as long as you are involving your domain experts, that can guarantee value. Or we always talk about crawl, walk, run. Don't try to start with a very ambitious project. Start with something that is valuable, it's measurable, it's simple. And then they can also save you from some of the ethical backlash that can come from a model that has a bias mm-hmm. or is doing some type of human behavior that was already happening, but now it is scaled.
Yeah, now I think that model bias is a really important consideration. And I think that will hopefully resolve itself as we get more data and get more models and go further.
And we've done a lot of that in the past where I tell people if you can predict it or monitor it, you can protect it. So hopefully it's monitored. You just have people are telling you the gender and race and they're giving that information or whatever else it is. If you don't have that, then hopefully you can predict it if it's important. And this comes up all the time. A lot of times people get nervous using unstructured data because what if there's a person in the image? What if there's something in the image that would give AI hooks into income level or something? And all of that is very addressable. But you have to have that conversation up front rather than being surprised downstream.
So, you know, to be honest, my big takeaway from our conversation has been not so much how far AI is advancing, but how much that journey is tied to us as humans and how it's a human and AI journey. And, you know, every sort of example you've talked about has been like, what is the human part? And, you know, this is something that people are very much closely involved in. And so that's, I think, really interesting and encouraging to me.
Yeah. And the human part, I think of that as the domain expert. We celebrate the domain expert. And so if we're in a meeting where you have engineers and data scientists, when the domain expert fills up, whether it's a VP of product or someone along those lines, I feel like, thank goodness, the adult has finally come to the meeting. Because engineers and data scientists can get very excited about things that are hard to quantify value-wise.
Excellent. Well, Ben, this has been a fascinating conversation. Thank you for taking your time out today from the summit to join us. For listeners who want to know more about your company and the work you're doing, where should they go?
They can go to zeff.ai, Z-E-F-F. I'm also very active in the AI community, Ben Taylor Data on Twitter and on LinkedIn. I do a lot of speaking and I love the space.
Excellent. Well, this has been a great conversation. Thanks, everyone, for joining. This has been the Intel on AI podcast. I'm your host, Emily Hudson.